actually informed me about the traffic stop by Officer Gallietti of the West Jordan Police Department. He also saw a cut on Arias's hand when she arrived in Utah, when he also immediately noticed that she had changed her hair color to brunette. Detective Larry Gladish of the Mesa Police Department would testify that powering off a cell phone would make it impossible for police to trace its movements. He would also tell jurors that Arias's cell phone was powered off just west of the Arizona border and turned on just south of the Nevada border. I would also call the custodians of records for the cell phone companies Verizon and Sprint to introduce the phone records should there be any question about the calls that were made. I don't normally script the order in which I call witnesses to the stand. It is almost impossible to adhere to it, because testimony may be longer or shorter than anticipated, and scheduling conflicts usually arise, making it impossible to pinpoint an exact date and time the next person will be called. I made an exception in this prosecution for the testimony of Arias's friend, Leslie Udy, because I wanted her to be the last person the jury would hear before turning the case over to defense counsel. After Arias was notified of Travis's death, she called Udy on the morning of June 10th. Udy would recall that Arias was distraught and crying, asking how somebody could do that to Travis. As she sobbed, she told Udy that Travis was such a wonderful person, and she couldn't imagine why anyone would do that to him. Udy received a second call from Arias around 2 a.m. on June 11th, during which Arias was hysterically crying, explaining that this was the time of day that she would talk to Travis, and now he was dead. She said she had lost her best friend and didn't know what to do. As Arias sobbed about losing her best friend, she knew she was the sole cause of her supposed anguish, because she was the one who had ended Travis's life. This juxtaposition spoke volumes, and it would be a powerful image on which to end the presentation of my case, because it demonstrated how deceitful Arias could be when it was to her benefit. Chapter 15. When jury selection in the trial of Jody Arias for the murder of Travis Alexander began on December 10, 2012, it had been 1,646 days since his body was found and the investigation into his death had gotten underway. In that time, I had looked at this case from every angle and in every light. I'd spent nights and weekends at the office and nearly memorized every item related to the investigation. After 4.5 years of preparation, I could say that I felt ready to prosecute the state's case. It is always hard to know how a trial will go at the start. A trial is a drama that unfolds around you, and even as a key player, I recognize that I can only control my piece of it. All I can do is prepare as completely as possible and hope that my legal skills and mastery of the facts are enough so that justice will prevail. At the same time, I always try to recognize that things will happen around me that are unpredictable, and I need to be ready for whatever comes up. That's one of the reasons I like working alone. It allows me to think on my feet and react accordingly without consulting anyone as the case develops. In the weeks leading up to jury selection, I'd heard talk that the media intended to follow the Arias case closely, so I anticipated there would be a fair number of reporters in the courtroom for the start of jury selection. As it turned out, there weren't. In spite of the media's early interest in Arias and the requests for cameras to be in the courtroom to cover the proceedings gavel to gavel, only Grace Wong, a field producer from True TV, was present in the gallery to cover the proceedings on that first day of jury selection. I had seen this before with the media expressing an interest during the early stages of a case, only to turn their attention to more current news events when the trial date arrived. A lot of time had passed, and apparently the interest had gone with it. Jury selection in capital cases is a burdensome process that requires people to show up in court and detail private aspects of their lives in a public forum as a court reporter writes down their every word. So it is understandable that some are reluctant to share the intimate details in front of a room full of strangers and request to provide their answers in private, which calls for the other jurors to step out of the room while the judge, staff, and litigants remain behind to hear their responses. This is as private as the process gets. During my first interaction with potential jurors, I am always mindful that they are regular people and that even the subtlest gesture or facial expression may be misinterpreted, resulting in hard feelings towards me even before my first word has been spoken about the facts. I am careful not to show emotion by laughing, smiling, or continually speaking to the detective assisting me in the case. The courtroom is no place to be amiably chattering or chuckling. After each group of jurors filed into the courtroom of the Honorable Sherry K. Stevens, and at the judge's request, I would stand up and identify myself as the prosecutor in the case, taking that opportunity to also introduce Detective Flores by telling the prospective panel that the detective will sit with me throughout the trial. My introduction was followed by that of defense counsel and their client. Lawrence Nurmi was still lead counsel, but he was now assisted by Jennifer Wilmot, who had been assigned to the case in January 2012, replacing Victoria Washington. As was the case with Nurmi, I had never tried a case against Wilmot, and our interactions in the Arias case had been limited to our status conferences. In most cases, the selection process eliminates more than 50 of the prospective jurors from each group of the approximately 100 who make the trek from the first floor office of the jury commissioner to Judge Stevens' courtroom on the fifth floor. Those whom the court determines to have a hardship that precludes them from serving are dismissed, with those remaining instructed to return downstairs to the jury commissioner's area on the first floor to complete a lengthy questionnaire. Before those individuals are allowed to leave the courtroom, they are ordered to return the following week to be questioned further based on the answers they provide on the questionnaire. Copies of the completed questionnaires are provided to the prosecutor and defense counsel for review so that we can be prepared to question the potential jurors based on their answers. Reading the questionnaires is a tedious and time-consuming undertaking, and while I can ask a paralegal or another prosecutor to assist me, by doing so I risk missing information that may affect my decision as to whether that person should serve on the panel. As a result of this approach, I spend what feels like endless hours reviewing the 30-page questionnaires to make sure I don't miss anything important. The juror questionnaires address many areas, including the person's views on the death penalty and whether they would always vote for or against the death penalty without regard to the evidence presented at trial. In a capital case like Arias's, this is always an important point for both sides, as both prosecution and the defense screen out people who are strongly biased in one direction or another. There are also questions about the jurors' exposure to media coverage of the case, and jurors may be excused if it seems that they might not be able to remain fair and impartial. Arias's early television appearances on Inside Edition and 48 Hours did not present a problem in picking a jury for the trial, as most jurors did not remember seeing her on television. Jury selection in the Arias case was completed on December 20, 2012, after 6 days, with 18 jurors impaneled, 11 men and 7 women, who were given preliminary instructions by Judge Stevens that same day. With the date so close to Christmas, the court scheduled opening remarks for January 2, 2013. For most people, New Year's Day is a holiday celebrating a new beginning by making resolutions. But as the year 2013 got underway, for me it was a culmination of many years of work on this case. I don't go out on New Year's Eve, so I spent the next day at the office going over the case one last time to make last-minute preparations. Immediately before I went to court on Wednesday morning, January 2nd, I did what I always do before every court appearance and trial. I checked my hair in the small mirror I keep on the back of my office door to make sure it is neatly combed. I had been given the mirror as a joke at a Christmas office party some years back, and I have used it ever since, even though initially it was a source of teasing from my coworkers. For the first day of the trial, I wore a blue suit, white dress shirt, and peach-colored tie, not because the ensemble held any significance, but because it was the next suit and tie in line to be worn. I see it as a cliché to choose a power tie and suit for occasions, such as delivering an opening statement. Before I left my office, I repeated the first few lines of my opening statement so that I had them on my tongue, ready to deliver to the jury. After that, it was all about getting to court. I don't remember stepping onto the elevator and hitting the button for the fifth floor, but when the doors opened, I noticed a large crowd of people mingling in the hallway outside of courtroom 5C. Immediately, I knew that the quiet of jury selection had been an anomaly. The ID cards hanging from lanyards around their necks told me these people were members of the press corps, confirmed by the thick black wires running down the hallway to a satellite dish. The hallway looked as if it had been taken over, and the hum of voices bounced off the walls. So there is going to be gavel-to-gavel coverage, I thought. The scene outside the courtroom continued inside as well. I had no idea how many journalists were in the courtroom, but I could see as I entered that every seat in the five rows of the gallery was taken. Court officials had even added extra chairs, which still didn't accommodate all the people wanting to see the opening remarks. The other prosecutors from my office who had come to watch the opening remarks were forced to view the proceedings on a television in the victim's room. This was the biggest media event I'd ever seen at the Maricopa County Courthouse. As I walked to the prosecution table, I paused to acknowledge Travis's siblings, Samantha, Tanisha, and Stephen, who were seated in the front row of the gallery, behind the table where Detective Flores and I would be sitting for the trial. Also in the gallery, on the other side of the aisle, was Arias's mother, Sandy, whom I recognized on sight from her July 2008 interview with Detective Flores. She had sobbed through most of their conversation, so I hoped she wouldn't cry through these proceedings as she had back then. Catching a quick glimpse of Arias, I noticed that she appeared demure, quite different from the person jurors would soon see in the photographs of her lying naked and splayed out on Travis's bed. Arias was permitted to wear street clothes for trial, and her librarian look, which included a modest black top, a face free of makeup, and her straight brown hair cut with wispy bangs, was not lost on me. I believed her look, which would soon include glasses, was a deliberate attempt to inspire the jury's sympathy. She sat impassively at the defense table, with Wilmot, dressed conservatively in a royal blue skirt suit, to her immediate left. Nurmi sat in the lead counsel chair next to Wilmot, dressed in a tan suit, green shirt, and green patterned tie. Not long after Judge Stevens entered the courtroom, the proceedings got underway. But when the judge asked if I was ready to proceed with my opening statement, Nurmi stood up and took the opportunity to make an oral motion for discovery, which was denied by the judge after I explained that I had already turned over what he was seeking. As I stood up for a second time and started to speak, the judge stopped me and asked the court clerk to read the indictment to the jury, setting out the first-degree murder charge. The third time was the charm, and at last I strode to the front of the jury box to deliver my opening statement. "Good morning again," I began, referring to the other two unsuccessful tries at starting my presentation. "This is not a case of whodunit. The person who done it, the person who committed this killing, sits in the court today. It's the defendant, Jodi Ann Arias," I said, turning and pointing in her direction. "And the person that she done it to is an individual by the name of Travis Victor Alexander, a former boyfriend of hers, an individual that she was in love with, an individual that was a good man, an individual that was one of the greatest blessings in her life. And this love, well, she rewarded that love for Travis Victor Alexander by sticking a knife in his chest. And you know he was a good man, according to her, and with regard to being a good man, well, she slit his throat as a reward for being a good man. And in terms of these blessings, well, she knocked the blessings out of him by putting a bullet in his head during one event that occurred on June 4th of 2008. I continued, pacing the floor and gesturing with my hands to emphasize the three mortal wounds. I had chosen my words deliberately, based on what Arius had written on a card at Travis's memorial service. "Travis, you're beautiful on the inside and out. You always told me that. I never stopped believing in you, and I know that you always believed in me. Thank you for sharing so much. Thank you for all of your generosity. This world has been blessed because you have been here. I love you. Heart." Arius had written she loved Travis and called him a good man, a blessing in her life. So it was only fitting that I employ her words in my message to the jury. My presentation lasted approximately 1 hour and 20 minutes and included a chronology of Arius's and Travis's relationship, from their meeting and courtship to Travis's gift of the Book of Mormon, which the two read together, Arius's conversion to Mormonism, and their sexual relationship. To dramatize the brutality of the killing, I asked Detective Flores to hold up an enlarged diagram of the crime scene for jurors as I described the details of June 4, 2008. My back was to the gallery for much of my presentation, so I had no idea how people were reacting to my remarks, although I learned later that Travis's sister Tanisha had cried quietly, as did her sister Samantha. I was told that Arius cried too while I was describing how she attacked Travis as he sat naked on the floor of the shower, and how after the killing she had dragged his body back to the shower stall. My intention was to tell the story with words rather than through pictures, because my description could be more three-dimensional and the jury would see the disturbing photos soon enough. As he sat there, she took the knife and began to stab him when he was in that defenseless sitting position. Stuck the knife in his chest. He struggled. The slitting ear to ear took place, and by the time she was dragging him down, pulling him down towards this area right here, I said, pointing to the blow-up of the crime scene diagram, he didn't need that shot to the head. But she had a gun somewhere. She put that bullet right in his temple. In recounting Arius's many stories, I began with her initial statement that she was not in Arizona at the time of the killing, followed by her story about the two masked intruders who killed Travis but spared her life, and finally her latest version that she had killed Travis, but only after he attacked her and she was fighting for her life. "It was her," I affirmed. "She is the person who actually did this. She is the one who did the stabbing. She's the one that slit his throat. And she is the one that shot him." To dramatize my concluding remarks, I showed a clip from Arius's interview with Inside Edition. "No jury will ever convict me, and you can mark my words on that," a much younger-looking Arius tells the interviewer with an air of confidence as she appears to suppress a smile. "No jury will convict me." With her face frozen on the three monitors around the courtroom, I delivered my closing comment. "I also ask that you mark her words, the words that no jury will convict her, even though she has admitted that she's the person that did this after giving many different stories of what happened. And as you mark her words, I ask you, while you are doing that in your final deliberations, that you remember that while you're marking the guilty verdict for her premeditated killing of Travis Alexander. Thank you." There was no time for me to reflect on my opening statement. Even before I sat down next to Flores at the prosecution table, I was already thinking about my first witness, Mimi Hall, who was outside the courtroom and ready to testify. I was also wondering what Arius's counsel would say on her behalf. Through the years of wrangling at our status hearings, I certainly had my ideas about what direction they would take, but I was curious to see if my instincts were correct. After a 10-minute break, it was Jennifer Wilmot's turn to make her opening remarks. "Jody Arius killed Travis Alexander," she told the jurors. "There is no question about it. The million-dollar question is, what would have forced her to do it?" This strident admission relieved me in a practical sense from having to prove that the petite woman sitting quietly at the defense table had done all of this, stabbing a man who was bigger than she was, dragging his body down a hallway, and stuffing it in the shower. When I heard Wilmot tell the jury of Arius's decision to take a detour to Arizona on her way to Utah, I wanted to nudge Detective Flores to signal him to listen closely. "Travis knew that Jody was planning a trip to Utah because they had talked about it," she informed the jurors. "He knew that she was going to stop along the way and see friends of hers. He kept asking her to stop and see him. And at the last minute, Jody decided that she would veer off and take a short trip to Mesa to come and see Travis at his beckoning." When I heard Wilmot say that Arius's visit to Travis was a last-minute decision, I thought that defense counsel must have assumed that I hadn't taken note of what had been said in the interview summaries that the previous defense counsel had disclosed to me. But I had certainly given them my full attention, and I was going to wait for the opportune time to use what I knew during the trial. Wilmot continued her remarks, employing a strategy I had expected, painting Arius as a victim, a person to take pity on, someone to protect. "And through this trial, you will hear that Jody was indeed forced," she explained, putting up several of the photographs that had been retrieved from Travis's camera. "In just under 2 minutes, we go from the last picture taken of Travis in the shower, in just under 2 minutes, to the picture of Travis's body. You can see the foot in the front, with his head and his shoulders, and blood clearly on his shoulders. In just those 2 minutes, Jody had to make a choice. She would either live or she would die." Wilmot described a number of lurid sexual encounters that had allegedly occurred between the two, portraying Arius as a sexual servant who was only doing her job by submitting to Travis's desires, and none of this was her fault. Wilmot was setting up a characterization of Travis as an abuser, someone who bullied Arius into having sex with him. As Travis would explain to Jody, oral sex really isn't as much of a sin for him as vaginal sex, and so he was able to convince her to give him oral sex. And later in their relationship, Travis would tell her that anal sex really isn't much of a sin compared to vaginal sex. And so he was able to persuade her to allow him to have anal sex with her. It was a graphic start to the defense's case, and as much as I'd known that this sexualized commentary would be a part of their argument, it was still striking to hear those words said aloud in open court for the judge, jury, and spectators to hear. Ever since she'd changed her plea to self-defense, I'd assumed that tainting Travis's character would be central to her case. After all, Arius had been willing to accuse him of pedophilia, so nothing Wilmot was saying was truly shocking. What I hadn't known was how they would choose to deploy these sexual details for the jury, and with these words at the start of what was sure to be a long trial, they sent a strong signal that they were going to press this point at every turn. After hearing the sexually explicit lead-off, I felt a bit reassured, mostly because I didn't see it as the best strategy. Each of the extreme images that Wilmot's words conjured up held shock value for a jury, but I'd always found that for maximum effect, you had to be careful when using extremes. Just as with showing a crime scene photo too many times, a jury can get desensitized to graphic language. I'd seen it happen before. When strong words become a refrain, sometimes they can have the opposite effect, callousing the jurors instead of persuading them. The other risk here, which was both more subtle and more dangerous to the defense case, was that the use of overly sexualized language and images could potentially overshadow the other aspect of her case, which was that Arias was supposedly a victim. By going so quickly and so visually to the role that sex was going to play in this case, defense counsel didn't give jurors a chance to know Arias as a person and as a woman. They allowed these supposed acts to define her, and it is always harder to be the victim when the jury can't see who you really are. But there was no denying that this opening sent a strong signal, a shot across the bow, not just to me, but to everyone in the courtroom. Nothing would be off limits. Looking around the room at the sea of reporters, I found myself no longer surprised that the subdued atmosphere from jury selection had been abandoned. The media had come for a juicy story, and it seemed like that was exactly what the defense was going to give them. They appeared to be producing a story tailor-made for the media, and while it might play well on TV, I wasn't sure if it would do the same for the jury. Listening to Wilmot's opening statement, it confirmed that Arias was going to take the stand, because now she had to tell her story. It would be impossible for Wilmot to make an argument about Arias's sexual relationship with Travis in her opening remarks without Arias's testimony to back it up. Defense counsel's case would hinge on the success of Arias's appearance on the stand. It appeared they wanted to portray her as the victim. And she'd even dressed for the part. Chapter 16. There was about a 20-minute recess between Jennifer Wilmot's opening statement and when I would call my first witness, Mimi Hall. Mimi had been waiting in the prosecutor's work office outside the courtroom since about lunchtime, so during the break I went to tell her that she would be testifying shortly. When I found her, she indicated that she was nervous about taking the witness stand. I told her I understood her trepidation and suggested that we walk together to the courtroom so she could acclimate to the setting before all of the parties returned from break. Providing testimony in court can make people anxious, and in this case, the number of media in attendance and the fact that the proceedings were being broadcast to a national audience added another layer of apprehension. Mimi reminded me of a young Sigourney Weaver. She was slight of build, with curly, shoulder-length brown hair and horn-rimmed glasses. Her anxiety seemed to ease a bit once she saw the layout of the courtroom, and I explained how things would go once the proceedings resumed that afternoon. It was just after 3 p.m. when Judge Stevens returned to the bench, and I called Mimi to the witness stand. I had called Mimi as my first witness because I wanted her to set the tone for my case by describing her interactions with Travis and providing the circumstances under which she had discovered his body. Through Mimi, the jury would also hear that Travis had invited her, not Arias, to accompany him on his trip to Cancun, the event that I considered the trigger for Arias's rage and what led her to make the trip to Mesa to kill him. To dispel Arias's portrayal of Travis as sexually aggressive, I asked Mimi about his behavior on their three dates, which included hot chocolate at Barnes & Noble, a few hours of painting pottery at a local ceramics center, and an afternoon of rock climbing at an indoor facility. Mimi recounted that Travis was a total gentleman, explaining that the only physical contact the two had was an awkward hug at the end of each date. I also wanted to demonstrate Arias's pattern of confronting women she viewed as rivals. I thought back to Matthew McCartney's story of how Arias had driven hours to challenge a woman who she viewed as a threat to her relationship with McCartney, and how similar it sounded to the way she had approached Mimi at Travis's memorial service. "Where was this service held?" I asked Mimi. "This was at the church building where he went to church every Sunday in Mesa. It's off Guadalupe and the 202 area."
"And were there a lot of people there, yes or no?"
"Yes, there were a lot of people."
"And of all the people that were there, was there somebody by the name of Jody Arias?"
"Yes."
"And is the person that you knew as Jody Arias, is she in court today?"
"Yes. She is seated over there at the end of the table, and I can't see her clearly, but she's wearing black and has dark hair."
Mimi pointed to Arias, who was seated at the far end of the defense table. I asked the judge to have the record reflect that Mimi had identified the defendant as Jody Arias. "So you see the defendant there, and do you go up to her, or does she go up to you?"
"She came up to me, and she introduced herself to me."
"What did she say?"
"She said, 'Are you Mimi Hall?' And I said yes, and she introduced herself as Jody Arias."
"And did she say anything else?"
"I asked her how she was doing, and she said she was upset. That was about it, though."
"Did at any time she say, 'I'm the person who killed him,' anything like that?"
"No."
"Did she ever tell you why she was there at the memorial service?"
"No."
"I don't have anything else, thank you."
As I returned to my seat, Nurmi stood and walked to the podium in the center of the courtroom to begin his cross-examination. Based on his questions, it appeared his objective was to show that Mimi's standing in the LDS Church, which included having been born into the faith and attending Brigham Young University, an institution supported by the church, commanded a certain level of respect and dictated the way that Travis viewed and treated her.
"Did he, Travis, tell you that he was having sexual relations with Jody Arias?" he asked Mimi.
"No,"
she replied, appearing to grow uncomfortable.
"I'm not going to ask exactly what he said, but it was during a camping trip, if I recall correctly, that he told you he had a stalker?"
"Yeah. He didn't say a name at all, but he was having breakfast with a couple of friends around, and he told me at that point that he had a stalker, and that she had actually followed us on a date, and that she knew who I was. And I told him that was really scary and that he should get a restraining order."
This line of questioning caught my attention, and I wondered how far Nurmi would go into this area, which was highly inflammatory and could hurt his client. During my initial examination, I did not ask Mimi about whether she knew Arias to be a stalker or what she might have heard in that regard, because I didn't want to create any issues leading to a mistrial or being raised on appeal. Had I broached the subject first, the argument almost certainly would be that the prosecution had been unfair because these were unproven acts of domestic violence that were unrelated to the murder. But now that Nurmi was discussing Arias's stalking behavior with the witness, defense counsel was opening the door to the topic, allowing me to walk in and explore the details on my redirect examination.
"And you say that he didn't tell you. He didn't say that this was Jody, right?"
Nurmi continued.
"No, he didn't say who it was," Mimi responded.
She looked frail and vulnerable, and I felt sorry that she had to be up there on the witness stand and be asked about her friend's relationship with another woman. Nurmi showed her a page from a transcript to refresh her recollection of what she had said in an earlier interview where both he and I had been present.
"You said you gave him the advice that he seek a restraining order against this stalker, right?"
he asked. "Yeah."
"Okay. And you expressed to him that you were scared of this stalker, right?"
"Scared of any stalker. It's not something you want to deal with."
"And to your knowledge, did he ever seek out a restraining order?"
"Not that I knew of, no. He told me not to be afraid."
"And your testimony is that he never said to you Jody Arias was his stalker. That's your testimony?"
"That's from what I can remember. I don't remember him ever saying at the time. I remember hearing the name Jody. It could have been then, but I don't actually recall,"
Mimi replied, adding,
"The name Jody was mentioned the night that we found him at his house."
"Okay, thank you, Miss Hall," Nurmi said as he concluded his cross-examination.
My first question to Mimi on redirect examination continued the line of questioning that defense counsel had started when he asked her whether Travis had identified Arias as his stalker. "You indicated that part of what he, Travis, told you was that this stalker was a female, right?"
"Yes."
"And what had this female done that he was warning you about?"
Before Mimi could respond, Nurmi broke in with an objection. "Beyond the scope," he told Judge Stevens. Nurmi's objection was overruled because he had questioned Mimi about Travis's stalker.
He had dated someone earlier that year, Mimi replied, referring to Travis's ex-girlfriend, Lisa Andrews. She slashed her, Andrews's, tires. She had sent threatening emails to both Travis and his girlfriend at the time. She had followed us on one of the first dates that we went on, and she sounded dangerous. She had broken into his email account, his bank accounts. She would break into his house through the doggy door and sleep on his couch at night without him knowing that she was there.
Having this portrait of Arias out there so early in the case enabled me to cast doubt on her portrayal as a victim. This testimony showed Arias to be a woman who not only was obsessed with Travis, but would act on that obsession. The following day, I called Detective Flores to the stand. The first area I intended to cover with him was his initial telephone conversation with Arias on June 10, 2008, the one he had with her after leaving the crime scene to return her call. The jury would be hearing Arias's voice for the first time, and I wanted them to hear how engaging she could be, playing the part of the grieving ex-girlfriend. To ensure the jury understood that Arias had brought the gun with her to Mesa, a significant step in her premeditation of the murder, I played the portion of the telephone conversation with Flores during which Arias had admitted to the detective that Travis did not have a gun in his home and did not have any other weapons. Since Wilmot had admitted in her opening statement that Arias had killed Travis, this meant that Arias must have brought a gun and a knife with her when she paid him the early morning visit on June 4, 2008. Jurors sat impassively as I queued up the recording and Detective Flores's voice came over the sound system. Do you know if he had any weapons in the house? To which jurors heard Arias reply,
His two fists.
That's it? No handguns or rifles?
No, he wasn't one to keep any of that. No, only his two fists. No, he was more like into wrestling and UFC, and he had he said he just bought a punching bag, and he's like, I love beating the crap out of the punching bag, you know?
For the most part, Nurmi's cross-examination of Flores centered on Arias's comment about Travis's two fists as being his only weapon, and Travis beating the crap out of the punching bag as a way to illustrate why Arias was scared of him. But the fact remained that Arias had admitted to Flores that there was no gun in Travis's house, which could only mean one thing, that she had brought the gun with her with the intention of killing him. Nurmi's strategy of soiling Travis's character was evident in his final set of questions to Detective Flores when he asked about an agreement Arias had with Travis to clean his house. Do you remember whether or not she had to do it in a French maid outfit? Nurmi asked, referring to the photograph of the French maid outfit that Arias discussed with Detective Flores during their July 15, 2008 interview in Wairika. Pausing as if to search his memory, the detective responded, "That doesn't sound familiar to me." Later in the questioning, immediately before ending his cross-examination, Nurmi asked about an instant messenger conversation between Travis and Arias. Although the conversation he was referencing had occurred via instant messenger, Nurmi referred to it as an email communication when he asked, "Okay, do you remember seeing the emails in which Mr. Alexander referred to Miss Arias as a three-hole wonder?" "Yes," Flores replied matter-of-factly. "As a slut?" "Yes." "As a whore?" "Yes." "Thank you, Detective." It was clear that Nurmi's objective was to pick up where Wilmot's opening remarks had left off in painting Travis as a bad person. But introducing Travis's derogatory statements to Arias so early in the proceedings seemed a poor strategic decision, because as the trial progressed, Nurmi would do it so often that it became something he appeared to like repeating for its own sake, which lessened its shock value as well as its impact. When court reconvened that afternoon to continue with my redirect examination of Detective Flores, I was eager to give the jurors some insight into what had motivated Travis's offensive missives to Arias by providing the context in which they were written.
While I knew that there was nothing I could do to eliminate those words from playing a part in the trial, I hoped that offering a sense of what was driving Travis's emotions would soften their harshness.
I showed Flores a copy of the transcript of the instant messages the two had exchanged, and I asked him, "Why was the comment made as indicated in that document?" After an objection by Nurmi, I directed Flores's attention to the bottom of page 8 of the instant messenger conversation I had marked as an exhibit and handed it to him for his review. Flores spent a few seconds reading the passage before responding. "He, Travis, references being used by Arius," he replied. "What is he saying?" I asked, directing Flores to read aloud from the conversation. "I think that I was little more than a dildo with a heartbeat to you," he recited from the instant message.
"And that is what he is saying to her?"
"Yes. And the previous pages, pages 1 and 2 and 3, do they talk about whether or not to tell the truth?"
"Yes."
Before I could make my point, Nurmi interjected with another objection, which the judge overruled. "And in terms of the reference to the three-hole wonder, what is the context of that comment?" I asked Flores.
"Travis is complaining about her lying to him."
And with that, I ended this first portion of Flores's testimony. Over the next several days, I called a number of witnesses to introduce the evidence that had been collected at the crime scene to show it had been Arius who had killed Travis. Among them was the expert who discussed the blood spatter patterns that helped explain Travis's movements during the attack, the fingerprint technician who identified the palm print on the west wall as belonging to Arius, and a DNA expert who analyzed the hair and blood on the palm print and matched them to Arius. I began my direct examination of Mesa Police Detective Michael Melendez by asking about the incriminating photographs he had retrieved from Travis's Sanyo camera.
During my direct examination, I asked Melendez to explain the 5 steps that Arius had taken to erase pictures from the camera, as well as the process he had used to retrieve those photos from the unallocated space on the camera's memory card. No small feat in light of the fact that Arius had put the camera through the wash cycle with bleach. Another point I made through Melendez's testimony was that Arius had not deleted all the photos on the camera's memory card, only those that were taken on June 4, 2008, which implicated her in the murder. It was unavoidable that the explicit nature of some of the photographs caused a stir in the courtroom, especially the ones of the afternoon sex session, which included close-ups of Arius's breasts and vaginal area, along with photos of Travis and Arius posing nude on Travis's bed with a tube of KY jelly in the foreground. By introducing all the photos, including those of a sexual nature, the first of which was time-stamped at 1:44:52 p.m., I wanted to establish that Travis and Arius had spent a substantial amount of time together that day. And during that whole time, Arius had the gun and knife stashed somewhere nearby, ready to access them when the moment was right. I followed up that first set of photographs with the introduction of the pictures of Travis in the shower, with the first one bearing a timestamp of 5:22:24. Travis appeared very much at ease and altogether defenseless, without so much as a layer of clothing to protect him, as he poses nude in the shower for what the defendant had described to Detective Flores during their interview on July 16, 2008, as a classy photo shoot. The last photograph in that series, which was taken approximately 8 minutes later at 5:30:30, does not show Travis's face, only his torso and buttocks as he sits on the shower floor. Just 44 seconds later, the next photograph was snapped, which was the first of a set of 3 inadvertent pictures that capture parts of Arius's attack at 3 separate moments. In displaying this final set of photos, I wanted to show that less than a minute had elapsed between the time Arius admitted holding the camera to when the initial inadvertent photograph was snapped. As I showed him the first of the 3 inadvertent photographs, I asked Detective Melendez,
What do you see there?
It's the ceiling area and the upper wall portion of the bathroom.
And the time?
I asked, making sure to establish that it had been 44 seconds since the last posed picture of Travis in the shower was taken.
5:31:14, he replied, confirming the time gap.
I went from the photo of the bathroom ceiling to discussing the second inadvertent photograph, which showed a stocking foot in front of Travis's head, blood spilling from his neck onto his right shoulder as he lay lengthwise along the hallway with his feet toward the bathroom.
I asked, "When you recovered this photograph, were you able to know or tell whether or not the camera, when it snapped the photograph, was it right side up or was it upside down?"
"It was upside down."
"And how do you know that?"
"Because when I looked at the original image, it was upside down."
This meant Arias had carried the camera throughout the attack until she apparently dropped it as she went to drag his body back down the hallway.
"And this area down here?" I asked, pointing to Travis's right shoulder and the blood streaming to the tile floor.
"Can you tell what this is?"
"It's a stain. It looks like blood," he answered, knowing it was blood, but not committing to it because he hadn't tested it.
When asked about the third and last inadvertent photograph, Detective Melendez explained that this showed Arias continuing to drag the body toward the sink area. All of these photographs, starting with the ones taken in the early afternoon to those in the early evening, were so incriminating that it was clear why Arias was so concerned with wanting to look at them during her interviews with Detective Flores in Yreka, and why she came up with the excuse that she had killed Travis in self-defense. Having these graphic photographs now in front of the jury, I was interested to see how defense counsel would deal with them, since they contradicted Arias's assertion that she had been the victim. She obviously wasn't being forced to pose for the afternoon nude photographs, and she showed her physical strength as she dragged Travis's limp, 189-pound body down the hallway. In her cross-examination of Detective Melendez, Jennifer Wilmot focused on questions related to the time gap between the last photograph of Travis in the shower and the first inadvertent photograph of the bathroom ceiling, apparently hoping to signal to the jury that while the pictures placed Arias in the bathroom of the master bedroom, they didn't capture the attack in its entirety, allowing Arias to argue what may have happened during that undocumented period of time. It would have been fruitless for Wilmot to challenge any of the photographs, so she resorted to pointing out what she labeled as a 45-second gap between the pictures, because that was the only unaccounted time period that would allow Arias to make her self-defense claim. Because the case was being televised, I was the subject of media scrutiny almost from the inception of the trial, particularly with regard to my courtroom presentation, which was being described as too animated and at times combative. The criticism was brought to my attention so that I might conform my style to what some in the media thought was a better way to approach the prosecution of the case. I was a little taken aback by the criticism, as this had always been my approach, and juries seemed to have appreciated the passion I had displayed during my previous presentations. I was not putting on a show because the media was in the courtroom, but was trying the case as I would any other. I had to follow the style of prosecution that had worked well for me many times before, so I ignored the criticism, always reminding myself that it was the jury's opinion that mattered. My conduct in the courtroom would come under further scrutiny during my redirect examination of Detective Melendez. As I was holding Travis's camera in my hand, I suddenly dropped it on the floor, to the surprise of everyone in the courtroom, and asked the detective, "Did that take 45 seconds, sir?" My dramatic gesture drew a strong objection from Wilmot.
"Judge, I am going to object. That's evidence that was just dropped on the floor," Wilmot shouted, an objection that the judge immediately overruled. I hadn't planned to drop the camera. I did it in response to Wilmot's implication during her cross-examination that it had been Travis who had initiated a confrontation during the 44-second gap. It was a way of illustrating that although Detective Melendez did not know what had happened during those 44 seconds, whatever had happened occurred unexpectedly, just like the camera hitting the floor. And it showed that just as everyone in the courtroom had been caught by surprise, so had Travis when Arias attacked him with the knife. Chapter 17. The case I had presented thus far was based in large part on the investigation by the Mesa Police Department and left little room for the jurors to conclude that anyone other than Jody Arias was solely responsible for killing Travis Alexander. But there was still the issue of premeditation for the jury to consider and decide, and with that in mind, I turned to the efforts of other agencies that had assisted in the inquiry, including the Yreka Police Department, the Siskiyou County Sheriff's Office, and the Maricopa County Office of the Medical Examiner. Dr. Kevin Horn, a graduate of the University of Maryland, had been with the Maricopa County Office of the Medical Examiner since 2001. My objective in calling Dr. Horn was to describe Travis's many injuries, the order in which they occurred, and how these injuries led to Travis's death. Dr. Horn would also be able to address the defense's claim that he had given erroneous information to Detective Flores that contradicted his findings with regard to the sequence of the injuries Travis sustained. With Dr. Horn on the stand, I moved to introduce 41 autopsy photos to supplement his testimony. There were photographs showing the injuries to Travis's head and body, as well as photographs of several X-rays that indicated where the bullet had come to rest in his left cheek. I began my presentation by putting the first photo of Travis's face onto the ELMO, E-L-M-O, courtroom system, which projected it onto the three monitors strategically placed around the courtroom. The ELMO was connected to a large movie-style screen that dropped down from the ceiling for jurors to view, as well as to two TV monitors, one behind the witness stand and the other facing the gallery. This first picture was a close-up shot of Travis's face, which appeared purple and splotchy in areas and showed the gunshot wound above his right eyebrow. I saw Travis's siblings in the first and second rows out of the corner of my eye and realized the presentation was affecting them, as both Samantha and Tanisha had started to silently cry. I know that for family members and friends of the victims in the courtroom, listening to the testimony is never easy. Still, I had a responsibility to present the best evidence to support my case, and I focused on that. Having established Travis's identity by this first photo, I moved to the photographs of the X-rays, which would identify any foreign objects in either his head, neck, or chest, the areas that had sustained the mortal injuries. The most significant of the three was a frontal view of the head, which showed that the bullet had gone through the brain and come to rest just inside Travis's left cheek. According to Dr. Horn's testimony, the path that the bullet traveled was a downward trajectory, indicating that the muzzle of the gun was above the head when the shot was fired. Because she was at least 2 inches shorter than Travis, this trajectory implied that she stood over him as she fired the gun. Before we talked about the multiple injuries he observed during his visual examination, I asked him to explain how he determines whether a wound has been inflicted before or after death. If there's hemorrhaging associated with an injury, then it is before death, he said. What is it that causes a person to hemorrhage? If you have a heartbeat, you are going to have blood flow to the area that's injured, and so you have blood flow from an injury. So if the skin is cut or torn, there will be a great deal of blood that will come from an injury in a living person, Dr. Horn clarified. A deceased person will lose some blood, but not a great deal. If an individual is dead and somebody applies some force, hits them, are they going to bruise necessarily or not? I asked. There may be something that would look like a bruise, but it will not be as large and the color will be different in a deceased person because there is no blood flow to the area. "Are you familiar with the term defensive wound?" I asked, eager to have Dr. Horn speak to the deep incisions on Travis's left hand, as illustrated by the next autopsy photo I put up for the jurors.
"Yes," Dr. Horn replied. "They're based largely on location on the body. If you have injuries to the back of the forearms, or to the palms or backs of the hands, you can have gunshot wounds in those locations, or in the case of an assault with a knife or an edged weapon, you can have cuts or incised injuries to the back of the palms or backs of the forearm. And it's consistent with someone trying to either grab the knife or fend off wounds or fend off injury."
To illustrate the concept of defensive wounds, I pointed Dr. Horn to the photo of Travis's left hand and asked him to explain the injuries in the image. Dr. Horn determined that all the injuries on the left hand were consistent with defensive wounds. Dr. Horn couldn't identify the kind of blade that was used to inflict the injuries, but could only say that it was a sharp-edged object. Speaking about all of the wounds on Travis's left hand, I asked, "Are they consistent with defensive wounds?"
"Yes."
"And does that mean that Mr. Alexander was alive at the time these injuries were inflicted?"
"I believe he was."
I next displayed a photo of Travis's naked body lying face up on the autopsy table, showing the areas from the top of the head to just below the genitals. A number of incision-type injuries and stab wounds were visible in this photo, including the ear-to-ear gash to Travis's throat. There was a perceptible reaction in the courtroom, and I could feel the tension as I began asking Dr. Horn to provide details of each one. He began by describing a 1-inch superficial injury on the right shoulder before moving on to the 3 stab wounds to the chest, starting with the one right near the biceps.
"That one goes all the way to the breastbone," he said, "but does not go all the way to the chest cavity. It would not be fatal."
The same could not be said for a second, deeper wound in the middle of the chest area that he described as a stab wound.
"That one actually penetrates a major vessel coming into the heart," he said as he explained how the vein drains into the heart.
"So what happens when the knife goes in and causes this amount of damage?" I asked.
"Well, depending on the position of the body, you may have significant internal bleeding. Or if the person is leaning forward, they may bleed outside the body because there's a tract leading from that vessel outside. But this was a major vessel. It's not going to bleed as fast as an artery, but it will bleed a considerable amount."
With regard to this considerable amount of bleeding that's going on, is this a wound that could kill this person? I continued.
"Yes."
"And do you have an estimate, or is there any science out there that tells you, well, this type of wound, given what I know about it, would take X amount of time for death to ensue?"
"No," Dr. Horn replied. "It depends on so many factors. It depends on the person's health. It depends on the care that they received. It depends on their blood volume to begin with and the position of their body."
This was an important detail to spell out because I wanted to establish that Travis had been experiencing mental anguish and excruciating physical pain after the initiation of the attack, proving he was the one who needed to defend himself, not Arius, as she alleged. Dr. Horn went on to describe that while eventually unconsciousness would result from the wound, it wouldn't happen right away.
"When you say eventually, do you have an estimate, maybe minutes, seconds, between the time of infliction and the time that he lapsed into unconsciousness?" I asked.
"If that were the only wound, and it's not, probably a few minutes, because we're dealing with a vein and not an artery, so it's a low-pressure system, so blood loss is slower. With this wound to the heart, he should have been able to get his hands up and attempt to defend himself."
"If he was in a seated position when this wound was inflicted, would he have the ability, even though this was inflicted, to get up and walk somewhere or move quickly somewhere, as a matter of fact?"
"Yes."
Dr. Horn's answer, when considered along with the evidence collected at the scene, confirmed the sequence of the mortal wounds. While the stab wound to the chest would eventually be fatal, Travis would still have been conscious at first, giving him the opportunity to grab at the knife, as shown by the defensive wounds on his left hand. He also had time to make his way to the vanity, where he stood bleeding over the sink while Arius stabbed him repeatedly in the back, resulting in the type of blood spatter patterns identified by Lisa Perry on the mirror and sink. The large ovoid stain on the carpet at the threshold between the bathroom hallway and the master bedroom confirms that after standing at the sink, Travis got as far as the doorway before collapsing to the floor, where Arius slit his throat from ear to ear, causing his neck to bleed profusely. The left palm print swathed in Travis's and Arius's blood on the west wall, along with the inadvertent photographs, detail Arius's next move, which was to drag the body back down the hallway into the bathroom. She stopped dragging his body in front of the sink long enough to shoot him in the head while he was on the ground, with the downward trajectory of the bullet leaving no doubt that she stood over him when she fired the single shot. The casing from the semi-automatic gun was ejected, landing in a pool of Travis's blood that he had previously shed. She completed her ghastly pilgrimage by dragging the body the rest of the way and shoving it into the shower, where it stayed until it was found 5 days later. Dr. Horn also discussed other non-lethal wounds, which included a 5 3/4-inch puncture by the belly button that he believed had been inflicted from left to right and slightly downward, as well as contusions on the right leg that were consistent with the body having been dragged. Travis had also sustained a grouping of 9 injuries to the back, which were visible in the next photograph I displayed. More likely than not, they occurred close in time, and they, a lot of them, most of them, have the same orientation, Dr. Horn explained, referring to a cluster of 9 wounds on the upper back. In general, except for one exception I can see at the lower edge, they are oriented exactly the same direction. They are in a diagonal extending from the right shoulder toward the lower left side of the back. From Dr. Horn's testimony, it was clear that Arius had the knife in her right hand when she inflicted those wounds, as he stood facing the sink with his back turned, which created the blood spatter patterns in and around the sink area. To illustrate this theory, I did a demonstration for the jury, motioning with my right hand as if I were holding a knife and repeatedly stabbing in a downward motion. And these injuries that we're talking about coming this way like that, could they be consistent with an individual having his back, as I have to you, turned to the attacker, and the attacker is stabbing him like that? I asked Dr. Horn. Yes. We have 9 injuries, and they are all clustered together. They're in the center, he explained, indicating their location on Travis's upper back. They're all about the same depth. They are about 1 inch, and they are going into the back part of the ribs and the spine, the spinal bone, and stopped there. And none of them entered the chest cavity. Of the 2 fatal stab wounds, the most significant one was the gaping slit to Travis's throat, which Dr. Horn described as so deep it passes through the airway so the windpipe is cut through. Let me stop you, I interjected. When it passes through the airway, does this individual lose the ability to scream at that point or not? It's below the larynx, below the voice box, so yes, Dr. Horn replied. This was disturbing because it suggested that Arius cut his throat to stop him from calling out for help as he struggled for his life. And if this person, well, this person is alive at this point, according to you, right? He's still alive? Yes. In a literal sense, this left Travis gasping because the air from his lungs was now being pushed through the gash in his throat rather than through his nose and mouth, causing agonal noises as the air was expelled. "Where would the blood start coming out as a result of this wound here?" I asked, still pointing to the throat. "Well, right next to the windpipe are the major vessels of the neck. You've got the carotid artery, you've got the jugular vein. My examination did show that the jugular vein and the carotid artery on the right side were both cut," Dr. Horn said. It was during this part of Dr. Horn's testimony that I noticed Arias, dressed in a blue top and black cardigan, hiding her face behind thick strands of her long brown hair, as if trying to shield herself from the graphic images being displayed for the jurors. At certain moments, she appeared to be crying behind the thick-framed glasses that she had begun wearing during the trial, raising her left hand up to her eyes as if to wipe away tears. As the presentation continued, she was either turning her face away from the images or staring blankly as they appeared on the monitor, which made me wonder if she was just feeling sorry for herself because she got caught. I didn't let myself get distracted by her performance, and instead continued my direct examination by asking Dr. Horn to describe the depth of the wound to Travis's neck. "It goes all the way back to the spine, so it's 3 inches, 4 inches," Dr. Horn continued. "It doesn't go through the spinal cord, so it doesn't penetrate that bone. So it's actually the soft tissues in the front of the neck and then stops at the bone." Once this was inflicted on Mr. Alexander, is this something that's number one, rapidly fatal? And number two, what about lapsing into unconsciousness? If you could talk to us about those two things. "He has two major vessels in this throat that have been cut. He's going to lose a great deal of blood very quickly. He's going to lose consciousness within seconds, likely, and then die a few minutes later." "In terms of unconsciousness, how much time are we talking about?" "A few seconds, probably." We had talked about the two of the three mortal injuries, the stab wound to the chest and the slitting of the throat. Now I introduced a photo that depicted the gunshot wound visible just above Travis's right eyebrow. "And what's the trajectory of this gunshot wound?" I asked Dr. Horn. "It passes down through the skull, passes through the face and downward and to the left, and terminates in the left cheek." Dr. Horn told jurors he didn't know the distance from the muzzle of the gun to the temple where the bullet entered the head, but he was able to determine the trajectory. "The problem in this case is that the brain was decomposed," he explained, "and the brain is a very soft structure to begin with, so it falls apart very rapidly after death. So I was not able to see a track through the brain. But just because the bullet passes through the front of the skull where the brain normally would be, I have to conclude that the brain was perforated." "And if the brain is perforated, what would happen to this individual once he was shot?" "He would be incapacitated," Dr. Horn replied. "Went down?" "Yes."